This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Tutu Alicante grew up in the African nation of Equatorial Guinea. When he was a young man, he witnessed brutal violence in his hometown. The military came to squash a revolt. They killed some of his neighbors and burned down houses, including his own. That day, Tutu dedicated his life to bettering human rights of those who are still in his country. He moved to the U.S., founded a nonprofit called EG Justice. It's dedicated to human rights and transparency for the people of Equatorial Guinea, and he joins us on our program today. Tutu Alicante, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure being here.
Tell me about growing up in Equatorial Guinea.
Well, I would like to start by perhaps giving your audience a brief sense of history, where Equatorial Guinea is geography also. So this is not New Guinea, this is not Guinea-Conakry or Guinea-Bissau, and this is not French Guyana in South America. This is Equatorial Guinea on the West Central African coast. Equatorial Guinea has the peculiarity of being the only Spanish or former Spanish colony. So with that, we have the heritage of, you know, the Spanish language, the Spanish religion, but also 200 years of colonialism. And what 200 years of colonialism does to the sense of peoplehood in that country, what it does to the economy of that country, what it does to politics, you know, ideas of politics, particularly when you gain independence at the time when Franco, who was a dictator in Spain, was still ruling over Spain.
1968, right?
This is 1968. So basically, all the infrastructure, political, social, economic infrastructure that we inherited from Spain are ones that were already broken in terms of, you know, an independent country that could aspire to become democratic. So that's one peculiarity of Equatorial Guinea, the connection to Spain, you know, which we are happy to get back into. The other peculiarity, you know, is that Equatorial Guinea is, in my mind at least, the prime example of what a kleptocracy is. In Equatorial Guinea, by all definitions, by definitions of any human rights, established human rights organization, is a totalitarian dictatorship, right? We have the same president in power since 1979, America, President Carter was still around, right? Yeah. So imagine how many presidents we have had since in America, how many of them served two terms, yet we have the same people. I was 6 years old when President Obiang came. So we have a government in place that for the last almost 40 years have not allowed any freedoms in that country. There is this conversation that we're having here couldn't happen in my country because there is no freedom of the press. There are no independent radio or TV stations. Freedom of expression. There is no freedom of expression, no freedom of association. People, my colleagues, are continually detained, tortured, imprisoned. So there is no basic freedoms in this country. And that people get when I talk about, you know, this being a dictatorship. What people often do not get, you know, is the fact that, you know, this is a kleptocracy, you know. And by that I mean a government of thieves. People that have set up to loot the entire estate, the entire resources of that nation, you know. So you have basically a mafia, in our case, a family-run mafia that's only there for the purposes of benefiting, enriching themselves.
And this has been common in post-colonial places. Africa is one continent that we can talk about, but in the post-colonial world, in which particularly when a small country that's carved up, the networks obviously before colonialism were far broader and people traded and negotiated with themselves on the continent in a very different way. So I've got this tiny country, very easy to play into the hands of larger nations, developed countries, who work very closely, including the United States, with these very dictators, because they do play into the hands of and make it very comfortable for the leaders of other countries.
Exactly. Today, Equatorial Guinea, thanks in part to the United States, it's the wealthiest nation in Africa on a per capita basis. Right, we have the highest GDP per capita in Africa, which is on par with many European nations. Right, and again, that's because of the history of colonialism, and now the history of the ongoing history or relationship of neocolonialism, a country that are now that's now completely dominated by American multinational companies in the oil sector.
Wealthiest country in Africa per capita, but not the wealthiest people in Africa.
Not the and that's where, you know, I always try to draw a distinction, right? You know, GDP, when you look at the GDP per capita, yes, we are right up there with England and France and Japan. But then when you look at human development, then you realize they were down with Haiti and with other poor nations, right? That disparity or that paradox is one that specifically defines Equatorial Guinea.
So what was it like for you? Forgive me for interrupting, but I'm mm-hmm. trying to imagine what that would be like for one young man growing up in Equatorial Guinea. Your experience. How did you experience that?
What that paradox means for me and for many people in Equatorial Guinea, the majority of people, is that you're living in this country that's the wealthiest on Africa, yet my sister Chiquitina, for instance, died in a hospital, bled to death in a hospital due to a minor complication of a pregnancy, right? So you're living constantly with poverty when you know that the son of the president has mansions in Paris, in Cape Town, in Brazil, in Malibu, etc. So you live that poverty day in, day out. You know, same thing happened to my cousin, Bujin, who also died in a similar situation. And I can assure you that every single Equatorial Guinean has a similar story of a family member that perish for something completely avoidable, you know, a disease that's completely curable. It also means that, you know, your nieces and nephews, even still today, are still having to walk miles and miles every morning before going to school to go get water, right? And these are basic rights that, if we get into it, you know, the government of my country have signed these covenants at the United Nations and other places to ensure that, you know, these rights, basic rights, are met given the resources that the country has. Yet they don't do anything about it. The UN does not step up. One of the things that you realize now, for instance, you know, is that Equatorial Guinea is one of the rotating members of the UN Security Council. So, you know, there's all these inconsistencies, you know, in terms of what's happening inside, what's happening globally, that for myself, you know, I struggle to understand.
My guest today is Tutu Alicante. We're talking with him on the state of things. Grew up in the West African nation of Equatorial Guinea, now works to bring human rights to that country. You had an important moment for you when you were a young man mm-hmm. and the president sent essentially his forces into your town mm-hmm. looking to revenge, I mm-hmm. guess, a rebellion. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have to say that, you know, my whole life have been there have been a series of events that have shaped me, right? My relationship with my father, the time I spent in a seminary in Canary Island, in Tenerife, trying to become a Catholic priest, and what happened afterward. And the event that you just mentioned, what happened in Anobon, the island that I'm from. Anobon, the island that I'm from, you know, is very isolated from the rest of Equatorial Guinea.
And we should point out that there are these islands off the coast of Equatorial Guinea that
Indeed.
Play an important part.
Indeed.
And that's where you were raised. So
exactly.
You're talking about
it's the only island, in fact, south of the hemisphere, south of the equator. Uh-huh. The rest, Malabo, where Malabo, the capital city, is above the equator, the continental side also above the equator, etc. But I had just come back from the seminary where I had lived this incident that completely changed my mind. You know, I have all my life I've been thinking I was going to become a Catholic priest. I live over there for certain reasons that, you know, I still feel very comfortable about. 1993, I get back to Malabo, and the military was sent to my country to put down a revolt, a group of young people who, instead of revolt, I'll call it, there is a Spanish word called reivindicación, which I haven't found a great translation in English yet. It's claiming, reclaiming something that intrinsically, something that inherently belongs to you, right? And this is what these young men were doing. And this is what I was doing in Tenerife, right? You know, it's saying, I am a human. I live on this island. The way the government is treating me, the rape, the abuse that is happening in my community is unacceptable. I'm a citizen of this country and I deserve certain rights by virtue of being a human, right? The event happened. The military was sent in. And within a span of 2 days, all the young men between the ages of 15 and 30 had been arrested, tortured, two of them, Simplicio and Manuel, killed a very close range. And what struck me about that, you know, is that afternoon having a conversation with my father in which I asked him, this had happened to our community. Our own house had been completely burned to the ground. These two young men that we knew very comfortably, you know, had been killed. What can we do, right? And my father, and you have to know, you know, my father is one of the people they admire the most, and especially at those ages. Looking at these men that I believed was everything in the world, and seeing tears in his face and watching his inability to answer me and eventually blurting out, there is nothing we could do, for me was unacceptable, right? I refuse to believe that, you know, living in a nation, your own government could kill your sons, could burn down your house, could just completely destroy your community, and there was nothing you could do, right? And from that moment on, basically, I set to do something. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew we had to do something to bring about change in my country.
We will find out what he did. Tutu Alicante is my guest. We'll talk about his journey now to bring civil rights to Equatorial Guinea and by way of the seminary. So we'll talk about that. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, it's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Tutu Alicante is my guest, grew up in the African nation of Equatorial Guinea, decided he wanted to become a priest for a while, and after high school went to seminary in the Canary Islands. You talked about, obviously, Equatorial Guinea being a Spanish colony initially, and that meant a Catholic influence, and there was a Catholic priest who influenced you as a young man, right?
That is true. I mean, Eugenio Teo is his name. He's still alive. He is now in his 90s. And this man was the definition of integrity. I mean, this man lived his life with integrity and with full commitment to service, right? And he was at that point the president of Catholic Charities. And going around with him and seeing what he was doing, how he was changing people's lives amidst the poverty that existed in my country, made me wanting to do something like what he was doing. So I went to a minor Catholic seminary in my country and eventually went to Tenerife, which I alluded to earlier.
Canary Islands.
To the Canary Islands, yeah, Tenerife being one of them. Going to Canary, to Tenerife actually was interesting in the sense that, you know, when you come from a place like Equatorial Guinea, you haven't seen much. You're living in a dictatorship, right? So you don't have access to books. You don't have access to... Your thinking is somewhat constrained. Then I get to Tenerife, and all of a sudden, I encounter a lot of racism. You know, I go to the streets, and there is a reason why that is, right? You know, you have people that are living with a lot of resentments because they are called Africans by the Iberians, by the Spanish living on the Iberian Peninsula. So for them, when they see an African like myself, it's okay, someone that we can, all this resentment that we have, you know, here's a place where we can place it, right?
So these are racial hierarchies now.
Exactly. But for me, you know, that opportunity opened up the possibility, and coming from the experiences that I had with Eteo, Eugenio Eteo, the priest in my country, they pushed me to think outside the box. Now being in a place where all of a sudden I could learn about, you know, black theology, and I could learn about what was happening in apartheid South Africa and civil rights movement, and be fully immersed into liberation theology, the segregation that we were facing in the seminary in Canary Island is one that immediately shocked me, and, you know, inside of me there was something that was saying, you know, this is not Christian, this is not priesthood, this is not who you are, right? At one point, again, that word that I mentioned earlier, reivindicación, as a way of us black seminarians saying, you know, we want to be treated like everybody else, we decided to organize one day and say, you know, look, we're not going to go to school until the directors of the school talk to us. That led to us being kicked back to our countries, and it led to this private conversation with our bishop at that point, where he pretty much told me that, you know, look, if you want to be like the higher priest, you have to show the other cheek in the face of aversion. For me, I felt that I have shown my left cheek, my right cheek, and all the cheeks that I had. You know, so for me, accepting being treated as an inferior person only because of my race, my skin color, was not acceptable. You know, So I was kicked out of the seminary around at that point. But then that was again when, again, this 1993, when the event happened in my country, right? And what that led to is me coming to the United States at the end of 1993. In fact, December 31st, 1993. So I arrived in Knoxville, Tennessee the following year, which is another period of huge, humongous changes in my life at that point when I'm coming to the, you know, to the United States.
So what were you going to do in Knoxville?
Well, first of all, I don't know how many people know about Knoxville here. I hope people know. But, you know, Knoxville was interesting in many ways. You know, it was the first time I was in the U.S. And you have to know, when you arrive in Knoxville on January 1st, it's cold. You know, so coming from Central Africa to this very cold place, seeing people in January drinking iced tea, all these different things were, you know, incomprehensible to me, right? Knoxville, for me, was scary in some ways. But it was an adventure. You know, I was very excited about coming here and doing what I wanted to do, for acquiring the tools to help change what was happening.
What were your plans? Why Knoxville?
At that point, why Knoxville? I didn't know anywhere else in the U.S. I had seen coming to America. I had seen Prince Bel, what's it called? Fresh Prince of Bel Air. But I had no idea where America was or nothing. But there was a community of people from my country in Knoxville. So I ended up there. And being in Knoxville, I had to learn the language, right? I watch a lot of shows. And again, I come to Knoxville thinking I was going to become a journalist and write about what was happening in my country. But then I get there, and you know, in between watching Saved by the Bell and to learn English and Ben Matlock was one of the first shows that, you know, began to expose me to law, right? To law as a set of norms that could actually guide people's behavior, right? As a set of procedures also that ensure that, you know, people's wills were not ruling, but rather there was a set of norms, right? 1994. And if you remember, July 1994, O.J. Simpson happened. And then from there on, I was glued, like probably most Americans, glued to the TV, watching Robert Shapiro and all these other lawyers look at the law in very, very interesting ways, right? Because now, for me, law then gained a new meaning, gained a social and political meaning, a context that normally, when you're just looking at laws in a book, you know, you don't know about. All of a sudden, the word guilty or not guilty had a bigger implication than just a legal term. It was also a social and a political term. The same thing with race, you know, the fact that O.J. Simpson was black, it was more than just, you know, a social construct. You know, it became a very political issue in the midst of all of these legal issues that were being argued.
What was your sense of race in America, and did that trial change or at least refine some of your understanding of what things were like here?
So coming to America, I didn't have any sense of race. I had seen coming to America, and I know Eddie Murphy and Arsenio were black, and so I had a sense that, you know, it was perfect.
I was going to say, it's good thing you saw Matlock and not Andy Griffith, because otherwise you would not have known. But anyway, go ahead.
No, but, you know, after being stopped three times by the police in Knoxville, Tennessee, including one time where I was clearly coming from the law school with my books under my arms, and being stopped only because I was black and fit the description of someone they were looking at, my sense of race became very, very acute. You know, now all of a sudden I knew why it mattered, the fact that I was black in America. So, and it didn't matter that I could point out to this police officer that, you know, look, I just had an evidence class. They ended at 155. It's 160 right now. Therefore, there was no way I could have committed this crime that you say was happening in this neighborhood. All that didn't matter, right? So for me, you know, race became a lens through which, you know, I began to look at many things in this new country that I was. But Knoxville also exposed me to another way of looking at the law, right? Through law school and through undergrad in law school, I was exposed to some fantastic mentors, right? In undergrad, I had a professor, Rosalind Hackett, in the religious study department. This is a person from Oxford, England, but who had lived in Ghana, Nigeria, and taught all over the world, who helped me see or interpret what was happening in Knoxville in a different way. Same thing with one of my professors, Fran Ansley, a small woman from Tennessee, but they have gone to Harvard and have come back and had an interesting way of looking at the law as an instrument that could help change communities.
But let me ask you about that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop you right there because this is interesting to me. You go to seminary, you find out that Christians are hypocritical about love, right? And so that had to be some kind of a blow. But mm-hmm. if it wasn't, please correct me. Then you come to the land of the free and you find out that racism is as strong here as perhaps it was in the Canary Islands. Mm-hmm. And then somebody says, yes, but with the law, we can change this. We've had 200 years of law and 2,000 years of Christianity, and it hasn't changed. And I just wonder why you still hoped.
Yeah, because, you know, we financed, for instance, around that it wasn't law alone. It was law attached to community. She introduced me to the Highlander Center. The Highlander Center is an institution that is in very close to Knoxville, Tennessee, New Market, Tennessee, where a lot of the work that has supported the civil rights movement started there. And a lot of ongoing work right now is still happening there with minors in West Virginia and in Kentucky and other places, right? And these are people that are using the law, but with a very clear sense of, you know, how do we organize the community to be the ones pushing this change? My work today, you know, is about that. I mean, we're not filing lawsuits on our own. We're trying to engage the community in my country to do all this different advocacy, legal advocacy, non-legal advocacy that has to happen. So it's never the law alone because, you know, when you, as I was saying, you know, when you start looking at the contours of the law, you realize that there are political limitations, there are social limitations, there are all these different things in place that ensure that, you know, with law alone, you cannot get to where you're going, and which is why I'm still hopeful.
You go to Colombia?
I go to Colombia again, you know, but I have to say that, you know, my life I've been very, very lucky. You know, some of these things are so serendipitous that I have no idea how they happened. Colombia was one of them. I had already worked as a lawyer for the Migrant Farm Workers Institution in Nashville, Tennessee. I knew my way around the laws pertaining to the U.S. And now for me it was an issue of, you know, how do we use the law to address the issues in Equatorial Guinea, which is the reason I came here in the first place. I got to Colombia in 2004. 2004 was the same exact year that the U.S. Senate did an investigation into the Riggs Bank. This was a bank in Washington, D.C., and found out there was an account with over $700 million in the name of the president of my country. The report or the investigation that led to the report reveals clearly that oil companies, American oil companies, were bringing that money often in suitcases to the bank. He also revealed that this bank, the Riggs Bank, was completely bypassing all this banking regulation, all these anti-money laundering regulations to please a dictator, right? So, and again, things were happening in my country in terms of poverty. This corruption was happening. You could clearly see how the oil companies had a hand, if not more than a hand, in creating that kleptocracy that, you know, was being set in place, right? So I sought out a professor, Peter Rosenblum, who at that point, you know, was thinking, okay, how do we hold corporations accountable for human rights violations, for violations of environmental law, etc.? He was at Harvard, told me, look, wait, next year I'll be at Colombia, apply there, and I did, and eventually got in Colombia somehow. And that gave me an opportunity to work with Peter, learn what you do with the law to hold corporations accountable, and open up a number of doors to foundations, to organizations, you know, Global Witness, the Publish What You Pay Coalition, all these different institutions, Oxfam, all these different institutions that were trying to use laws and was trying to engage the community in ensuring that, you know, the U.S. would adopt enforceable mechanisms to hold corporations accountable for enriching corrupt leaders in places like Equatorial Guinea.
That Riggs Bank story is very interesting, although it was a difficult one to read. It was a lot of gray print, a lot of gray matter on the pages of the Washington Post. It implicated some of the leading politicians and longstanding political and powerful families in America who were complicit in allowing that to happen, to removing those regulations. So it was oil companies. It was one corrupt government and perhaps more in Africa. And it was a robust political establishment in the United States, entrenched and legally elected, all of them involved in this very complicated story. So when you talk about sort of how to dismantle this, it's pretty well connected, right?
It is pretty well connected, and it goes beyond those list of factors that you've named, right? Because 2008, 4 years later, only 4 years later, there was another investigation by the U.S. Senate that turned out how the son of the president was using American lawyers, American accountants, American...
The president of Equatorial Guinea.
The president of Equatorial Guinea, yep. I'm sorry.
That's all right. We've got tons of presidents involved in the news, and we just don't want to conflate them. But go ahead.
No, but how they were using all these different U.S. agencies, right, to create shell companies in America, you know, in places like Reno, Nevada or Delaware. And then buy multi-million dollar property. The president of my country, Equatorial Guinea, owns a mansion in Potomac, Maryland. Potomac is, I don't know, 20 miles from downtown Washington, D.C., perhaps, or even less. In Malibu, the son of the president of my country had an estate, a mansion that was worth over $35 million. He had a private jet. The largest collection of Michael Jackson memorabilia, you know, the glove, the jacket, the shoes, etc., is owned by the president of my country, you know. So, and all that was done with the help of American institutions, you know. So it wasn't just the bank. It was also accountants. It was escrow account holders. It was all these different people. And again, the laws for all these different institutions and agencies and people, you know, real estate agents, have not changed. You know, a lot of that corruption continues to go on. And this is happening in America, where simultaneously there are similar cases of corruption by the same people, the president and the son of the president of my country, who is now the vice president, going on in Paris, France, going on in Switzerland. You know, so it's not an action, isolated action or action by people that we don't know. These are people that we know very well are kleptocrats and are coming to our institutions to corrupt our system or to use our system for the purpose of benefiting themselves.
My guest today is Tutu Alicante, grew up in the African nation of Equatorial Guinea and now spends his life trying to bring transparency and democratic reforms. And we're talking about that today on The State of Things. So what is it? So you make connections in Colombia. You learn about all these organizations and NGOs. What about the networks themselves? I mean, obviously you understand them now, and others do. Any sense of sort of how to approach this? Because clearly if all of these governments are involved, it means there's a much larger network that's maybe pulling the strings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and what helped me understand those networks, you know, is my collaboration or my work with a number of organizations that have become critical to the successes that EG Justice, the organization I run now, you know, has had, right? Organizations like Human Rights Watch, the Amnesty International, Global Witness, all these big organizations, they had the resources, you know, and had a better understanding of how these international networks work. We spent a lot of many years with Oxfam, for instance, going to colleges and other places, trying to get people to support legislation in the U.S. Dodd-Frank Act 1504 within Dodd-Frank, which applies specifically to oil companies, to ensure that, you know, these oil companies would be a lot more accountable. But clearly, then you could see, you know, the influence that these oil companies, the American Petroleum Institute, for instance, which is all American oil companies, had on the Security and Exchange Commission and had on the government itself, you know. And you could see how Halliburton, a company in which at that point Cheney sat at the board, the influence that it had on the SEC and other institutions. So you know that, you know, this work was larger than myself and larger than many of the institutions we work with. The other thing that was clear, you know, is that the government of Equatorial Guinea was spending, there was a 2007, the government of Equatorial Guinea was the second, per capita wise, the second largest spender in Washington, D.C. in lobbyists, right? So there were millions of dollars pumped into Corvis Communication, Cassidy and Associates, and other law firms to whitewash what the government of my country was doing, right? And again, we're talking about government that violate every single human rights in the book.
Talk about the effort that your president made to get himself honored at the United Nations.
Exactly. So, for instance, with the United Nations, with that example, with UNESCO, in 2008, as the investigation are going on in the Senate about the corruption in my country, Obiang, the president of my country, decides to donate $3 million to UNESCO, right? UNESCO is supposed to be the UN agency that promotes education, culture, scientific knowledge. UNESCO accepts the money and decides to create the award. So I immediately went to several organizations, the Human Rights Watches and of the world, and saying, look, we have to oppose this. You know, this is completely antithetical to what the UNESCO should stand for. It's completely against what is happening in my country. You know, the government of my country does not invest in education. Less than 2% of the budget in my country goes towards health and education, right? While over 40% goes towards defense. So clearly, you know, there is an inconsistency here. It took us 4 years to persuade UNESCO to, instead of naming the award after Obiang, naming it after the country. So it became the UNESCO Equatorial Guinea Award, and they still granted the award. They still created the award. It was a complete charade. You know, if you were in Paris during those conversations, you could see the representative of Equatorial Guinea meeting with others, you know, you could see the blocks and you could see all this corruption. There is not nowhere else to refer to this going on at an institution that's supposed to be upholding the human dignity of people in places like Equatorial Guinea.
I'm talking with Tutu Alicante, the founder and executive director of the nonprofit EG Justice. You can find links to it at our website, dedicated his life to human rights for the people of Equatorial Guinea. And our conversation continues on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Tutu Alicante, who got his master's in law degree at Columbia while he was in New York City, got connected with several nonprofits, and then eventually moved to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. How'd that happen?
One of the best decisions I've ever made in my life was marrying my wife, Angela Stisi. And my wife is a professor. She's an anthropologist. Of course, when I married her, she didn't tell me she would take me all over the United States, right? We started in four places, Mississippi, when she was in Forest, Mississippi, doing her research. We ended up going to Santa Fe, to L.A., to Columbus, most recently to Tampa, and now here. She's now accepted a job here at UNC a couple of years ago, and which is why we moved here. I like Chapel Hill a lot, actually. I currently have a position at UNC with the African Studies Center as a visiting researcher, which exposes me to a lot of the things that are going on campus. You know, and there is an intellectual vibrancy here in North Carolina, and particularly in this area with the universities here, that you don't find in places like Tampa or certainly Forest, Mississippi, or many of the other places where my wife took me to. So I'm glad she brought me here, and I'm glad I'm here, and gives me a chance to talk to you.
Well, tell us about EG Justice. When did you form that? And tell us a little bit about how it was formed and what you do with EG Justice.
Yeah. So EG Justice, I launched EG Justice in 2008. And for me, you know, so when you work to bring about freedom, democracy, you know, is a stressful work, right? And there are certain things that I do, my hobbies that, you know, I love doing. One of them is cooking, and the other one is gardening. You know, you start with something, and within a few hours, or in the case of gardening, within a couple of weeks, you know, you see something beautiful, and that gives me hope. EG Justice, I see it as an extension of that, right? You know, if we want to talk about it as a gardening, I see it as a place where I'm planting seeds, hoping that one day they will grow. I know what the end picture could look like. I know we want freedom in my country. I know we want a country that is democratic, a country where there is justice and equality for everyone in the country, right? And for me, the way we get there, particularly having worked with international organization, they have a mandate, and yes, could come and help you do two or three things, but at the end of the day, like most big organizations, they have their own agenda, they have where they're going, right? So I wanted to create an organization that could be entirely dedicated to looking at, okay, how do we do three things? How do we collect information about what is happening over there so rigorously document human rights violations and use that information to then do the second thing, which is engaging in serious advocacy, right? Legal, where it made sense, and non-legal advocacy, you know, with the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Senate. You know, the U.S. is heavily invested in Equatorial Guinea. Billions of dollars from these whole companies are there. So how do we educate the population here about why paying attention to what's happening in Equatorial Guinea matters, right? And what role the U.S. had in that. So I wanted to do that, you know, educate people, do good evidence-based advocacy with the UN and others. And then the third thing we wanted to do also, you know, is engaging the people. You know, I strongly believe that, you know, you have to work with people at the grassroots, people that are affected by this work, engage them in bringing cases against the corporations, the government, take them to the UN, take them to the State Department, those places, and ensure that, you know, they are taking agency, they are taking that force step in ensuring that, you know, they're demanding what is theirs to begin with.
And of course, that makes perfect sense to get that organization on the ground. The people who are most affected become engaged, and they become really the strength of any kind of resistance movement. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they are the most vulnerable, and it is the most dangerous for them, right?
It is very dangerous, you know, and particularly when you live inside the country, and as most of my colleagues do. I can tell you that every single lawyer that worked with me has been arrested, most of them has been disbarred. Many of the people that work with me have been tortured, have been imprisoned. We might talk, I hope we get to talk about Ramon, one of the recent cases that we've been working on, who just spent 6 months in jail for committing absolutely no crime, right? So it is very, very dangerous for them. I myself have been called by the president of my country enemy of the state and a traitor, you know, so we know there are those risks, you know, but you know very well, you know, they always say freedom is never free, right? So there is something called assumption of the risk, you know, and when you know you're working on freedom, when you know you want democracy, you know it's going to come with risks. You know, you try to minimize those risks. Right. I haven't been to Equatorial Guinea because I know I'll be arrested, right? My family has not been to Equatorial Guinea. But there is a lot that can do, you know, being here. There is a lot that you can do going to Geneva and to the European Commission and different places, or to the African Commission in Banjul. You know, so there are different things that, you know, we can do that minimizes the danger to us. To those that are inside the country, is a bit harder.
Ramon is an example. Tell us about Ramon and how your group played part.
Ramon is a brave artist. You know, this is a political cartoonist who uses his art to denounce the situation that we have in my country, the situation of human rights, mm-hmm. corruption, you know, and this is rampant corruption. He left the country in 2011 and since then started a blog, Locos TV, in which every day he would come up with an image and then write something about that image. So he used that space to actually denounce the president and the presidential family. When I saw his work, I called him and said, Ramon, we should do a comic book here, right? And along with other colleagues, artists, writers, we came up with a comic book, Obi's Nightmare, Obi being Obiang, Obiang Nightmare. And the premise of the comic book was simple. You know, the worst thing that can happen to a dictator is perhaps waking up one day realizing that he's not the president, he's just a common man, and he has to navigate this absurd system that he has put in place. And that's what the book is about, right? Ramon was doing all this work when he was outside, living in Asunción, Paraguay. His wife, who is a Spanish citizen, was transferred from Paraguay to El Salvador, and he needed a passport. 2012, Ramon had destroyed his passport in protest of the situation inside the country, and at this point, he found himself needing an Equatorial Guinean passport. He tried to get it outside, couldn't get it, so he had to go back into Equatorial Guinea. A week after Ramon was inside the country, he was arrested. Ramon was arrested clearly, and we know this because he was interrogated, clearly because of his drawings. Yet they charged him with counterfeiting and money laundering, right? Which allowed them to lock him up for 6 months. During that 6 months, we did a number of things. You know, we went to the politicians, we filed documents with the UN and the African Commission, all the rapporteurs on freedom of expression, etc. But we also put together a coalition first of all, organizations that could reach out to artists, right? So CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, PEN International, all these different organizations reaching out to journalists, to comic artists, and encouraging them to every single day donate a piece of art in support of Free Nze Ramon. That's what we call the campaign, Free Nze Ramon. And what that did, you know, is immediately raise a consciousness among politicians, among international policymakers about what was happening in Equatorial Guinea to this man who was innocent. All he had done was drawing the president. I want to hope that, you know, I could draw Donald Trump right now and get out of here and I won't be arrested. And that's what you expect in any society. Any society, particularly that's sitting at the UN Security Council. That's not what we have in Equatorial Guinea. We engage a couple of lawyers inside the country who manage to use the local laws to hold certain people accountable. The police officer they had accused Ramon and others. And on the witness stand, this guy balked and told the truth about how he had been told to set up Ramon. His superior, he was just following orders from his superiors when he framed Ramon. So we have managed now to get Ramon out of prison. He's still in Equatorial Guinea, and now the next step is to get him some sort of travel document to allow him to come back and join his wife in San Salvador. He's still there. But clearly, that's an example of, you know, one of the things that Digi Justice does, right? Engaging a broad community of people outside, people inside, lawyers and others, they can go about representing the rights, the basic human rights of an individual whose rights have been trampled upon.
And that's reason to hope, because if you think of a dictatorship, you think of, you imagine this ironclad control of all the systems, including the criminal justice system. But at some point, the criminal justice system worked the way it should. What do you think? How did that work? How did that happen?
In the case of Equatorial Guinea.
Yeah, and in the case of Ramon, for instance, why does somebody crack if they think the president is with me? I've got him on my side, and crossing the president could be lethal to me. Why does a guy crack on the stand?
I think one thing that, you know, people don't know about dictatorship, you know, is how weak internally, how weak they are, right? There are two or three people that are financially benefiting from this dictatorship, without a doubt. But the majority of people in Equatorial Guinea are only there because of fear, right? And if you can put them on the stand and push them to the brink to where they either lose that fear or they realize that, you know, by not telling the truth, something will happen to them, they most likely will tell the truth, right? In the case of this young man, this police officer who made up this story, he found himself unable to lie. And one thing that the Spanish legal system has that in the U.S. you don't have is the opportunity for the accused to actually talk to the person they have accused them, right? And when Ramon came up and told this young man, look, I don't know what you have against me. I have no hard feelings towards you. But I want you to know that you have destroyed my life for the last 6 months, my family, etc. And I think the lawyers tell me that, you know, they think that had an impact. And because people are human beings, right? You know, we are humans. Right. And I think when you dehumanize somebody else, when you commit a great injustice against somebody else, it's impossible for you yourself not to be dehumanized. You know you're doing something that is inherently wrong. Most humans, I want to think, you know, are not inherently evil, right? So I think when you put in that position, when somebody whose life has been altered for the last 6 months faces you and tells you, you have destroyed my life, most of us will balk.
Yeah, and the hope in all of this, and what the hope that you can find in all of this, is that these dictatorships and any ruthless regime, whether it's in the United States or in another country, can actually be brought to heel, because there are cracks, there are always weaknesses, and the point is to bring communities together, particularly those most oppressed, and say, you know, there's actually a way through this. We can actually make this thing work, even though maybe for decades or centuries it's worked against you.
That is the case, you know. And another case, another example that shows that, you know, is the case against the son of the president. So in the U.S., we work with the U.S. Department of Justice, you know, the prosecutors and others, and the case was brought. But eventually that case settled. And all the properties that he had, the ones they had, they're still in the U.S., the mansion and a Ferrari, etc., were eventually seized by the government. And now we're thinking about how to send these millions of dollars back to the people in a way that does not end up in the hands of the same people, right?
I should just interrupt you for a moment. This is a suit that you all brought against the son
of the president of Equatorial Guinea.
The president of your country. And yeah. I'm talking to Tutu Alicante today, who's the founder and executive director of EG Justice. That conversation on the state of things. So tell us more.
So in that case, the case was brought actually against not the son, but his assets. So this was a civil asset forfeiture case against the assets. The assets were eventually seized, and now we have the proceeds from those assets, which we're working to repatriate, to send back to the country. A similar case in France, however, showed a shift of power from these people that are basically acting with absolute impunity inside the country to a situation where people felt empowered enough to say, okay, change is possible, or it's possible to hold these people accountable. In France, the case went to trial. I was one of the people testifying at the trial. And eventually, he was convicted. Theodorin was convicted, right? He had spent hundreds of millions of dollars in a property up in Avenue Foch, about 15 cars, you know, Lamborghinis, Maseratis, etc., antiques from Louis XIV, etc. And all that stuff was now not only being taken, but also the reason why he was convicted as a felon, right? And for the people of Equatorial Guinea, who are used to seeing these people as demigods, knowing that, you know, they can actually be convicted. We might not be able to convict them in our country because, you know, they own the judiciary, they own the legislative system, they own all the political systems. But outside, these people are vulnerable, right? That is very important, you know, and that gives hope. It gives me hope. But more importantly, it gives hope to many of the people inside the country who continue to live in poverty, right? Who see the wealth that these people have and know that, you know, something else is possible. A different Equatorial Guinea is possible.
There are many people all over the globe who are oppressed by this very same system, a global capitalist system that is the network under which all of these politicians operate and the corporations by whose rules we live. And so the question is, this is a global network. You're taking this on kind of one country at a time, your country, for very personal reasons, and you're being very effective. Is this the way through? Because it seems to me that you're talking about a very powerful global network that's extremely well organized. Do you do this one country at a time?
What is clear, you know, is that, you know, you don't bring about major change by working in silos, right? Martin Luther King says, injustice anyway is a threat to justice everywhere, right? So there's too much injustice in the world, you know, and focusing only on what's going on in Equatorial Guinea is never going to yield the results that you want, unless at the same time you're also focusing on what's happening in Cameroon, in Chad, in Gabon, in Central African Republic, all that region, and beyond. To give you a great example, right now, Yahya Jammeh, the former dictator of the Gambia, who spent 22 years completely traumatizing his people in the Gambia, is in exile where? In Equatorial Guinea, right? So if I'm not working to bring Yahya Jammeh to justice with the lawyers and civil society in Gambia to ensure that the ICC or someone can get their hands on Yahya Jammeh, my work is partial, right? If I'm not working to ensure that, you know, we can get a better policies from the African Union, from the UN Security Council, etc., my work is limited, you know, because this government, with the resources they have, they are going to continue to corrupt other systems, you know. So their effect, you know, has definite reverberations, you know, in the region and across. Our solutions have to be similarly global. We have to find regional and global solutions.
Tutu Elakante is the founder and executive director of EG Justice. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. You can find links to his organization as well, and also links to some of those cartoons that we talked about that Ramon has done in the comic book. Tutu, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. Good luck with your work.
It's my pleasure, Frank. Thank you very much.
Check out the website, stateofthings.org. The program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director, North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.